Okay, so before we get started, any questions now? You probably have had a chance to take a look at the syllabus and schedule and that kind of stuff. Any questions about anything you saw on those guys? Okay. Make sure you do get your prereq forms to me by Friday. Just heard there's likely a typo in the form, so I'll be correcting that right after class today. Just basically on the file naming stuff. So we're going to spend the first 10-ish minutes, probably, maybe 15 minutes, finishing up a short dynamics review, talk about a few concepts that at least partially won't come up until later in the semester, but kind of get them in your mind today. And then start right away on chapter 1. And in chapter 1, what we'll be talking about is called free vibration. So vibration when you have no non-conservative external forces acting on the system. So we'll talk about that in a second. So let's start out in our dynamics review. Talking about degrees of freedom. What's a degree of freedom, or how many degrees of freedom does a system have? What determines that? Constraints. Constraints, sure, that's a part of it. Any other thoughts? Sure, so you can think about it. How many ways can the object move, certainly? What directions? How many number of variables do I need to be able to describe, completely describe its motion? I think you might be better served how to think about it in configuration space. So how many, what's the minimum number of variables that I need to describe the configuration, uniquely describe the configuration of the system? Okay, so that's degrees of freedom. So, and the key point there is a minimum, all right? So we have, let's say, a point on a plane. How many degrees of freedom does that have? 2. Okay? So I have 2 degrees of freedom. What does that mean about how many equations of motion I'm going to need to describe the motion of this point? I'm going to need at least 2. Okay? Depending on the constraints, and we won't get to the type of constraints that do this, but you come to graduate dynamics, I could have a 2 degree of freedom system that needs 3 or 4 equations of motion based on the type of constraints it has. For what we are working on here, largely, number of degrees of freedom are going to equal the number of equations of motion you need. Okay, just know that's not always true. Okay, so I have 2 degrees of freedom. And the reason, you know, this is kind of a simple example, but I want to point this out because we have a choice of variables that we're going to use to describe those degrees of freedom. Okay, so there's 2 degrees of freedom, but we can pick whatever coordinates we want to describe them. So for this one, if that's maybe kind of capital X axis, that's capital Y, what makes sense to describe a point mass on a plane? Maybe X and Y. So if I call, maybe I do X and Y describe that point mass on a plane. How else could I describe it? I could use some kind of polar coordinates. So I could use R and theta, right? So I can pick x, y. I can pick r theta. I could pick r and phi if I wanted to. So the point I'm trying to make here is we have the choice here of which variables we want to use to describe the motion of a system. Sometimes using kind of polar type configurations are going to make more sense. We'll make the math part of solving those equations of motion easier for you. Okay. So I'm going to push on you guys to make this choice an explicit part of your solution procedure when you're modeling systems. Don't just always default to Cartesian coordinates. It's kind of the trend, habit of people that are just starting to learn this thing. Right. Polar, if you're getting to 3-dimensional, spherical, or cylindrical coordinates, often make a system way easier. Particularly once we branch out into 3D, start using multiple degrees of freedom. Okay, so I have a point mass on a plane. What about now? Let's try it. Blue maybe. That's some rigid body on a plane. How many degrees of freedom does that have? 3. So I can pick some coordinates then. How many? So I have, I can do the location of its center of mass maybe, and some rotation angle of the body. Right. I could do location of one endpoint and rotation of the body. Right. So you see, kind of the higher the number of degrees of freedom, the sometimes kind of the more combination of choices you have. Right. What can also drive an appropriate choice of what coordinates to describe your system is what your end goal is. Right. If I have some way to sense this rotation about its center of mass really easily, maybe I want to choose that as one of my coordinates, right? If I'm going to try to control it or something like that. Or maybe I can sense down here this position really easily, but not one out there. Right? So that might dictate your choice in an application of what those coordinates need to be. But overall, again, the point is you have choice of what these are. Okay. The dynamics of the system. Once you make a choice, you also, because the equations of motion are a property of the physical system itself, we can solve in one set of coordinates and transfer to another if we want as well. And the dynamics will be the same. Just how you're representing them, that's what these coordinates are, is what changes. All right. So, we'll stay over here in the corner for now. Let's look at a rotational example. We kind of didn't quite get all the way through the one on what we did last week. We'll start on this one, we'll look at it, and then something similar will come up hopefully before we get out of here. So let's look. We have perfect pen down to some mass M. And we're going to say, hey, we have T in the notes. Gravity, and let's call this angle theta. So I want to write the equations of motion of this simple pendulum system. We have a pure torque, T, about the pen joint, and we're going to assume that that link is of length L, massless and extensible. It's a perfect rod, in other words. And then our pen joint's perfect. Okay, so what's our first step to figuring out those equations of motion? Free body diagram. Good. What kind of forces do I have acting on this body? So I have some kind of reaction force. So draw those. I have weight. I have the gravity. And that's just mg acting on the mass. What else we have? We have the applied torque, right? Anything else? All right, what's my next step? We have forces. Remember those kind of one preliminary step that I'm kind of encouraging you guys to do, make it explicit. Think about what my coordinate frame, what kind of coordinate frame makes sense for the system. Okay? So what kind of coordinate frame makes sense for the system? Something at the pen, probably. So we're going to have some system that has maybe an origin at the pen. And maybe we're going to pick one like this. Right. So that selection of that fixed Newtonian frame at the pen gives me a positive, a theta is now in the positive k direction. Right. All right. So now we have, drew a free body diagram, we made explicit choice of some frames we're going to use to describe the system. Okay. How many degrees of freedom does the system have, since we just talked about degrees of freedom? I heard one. Everybody agree with one? Okay, so if we have 1 degree of freedom, what's a nice variable that, what variable described that pretty nicely for us? Anybody? Theta, okay. So we have system here. If picked, we're going to say, hey, we'll get to that Q a little bit later on, but for now, Think of Q as the coordinates we're using to describe the system. And it's a single one right now. So what's next? Next part is to figure out the equations of motion, right? So what's a little bit unique, what's nice about this system is going to make that somewhat easy for us? It's pinned. It's in pure rotation about 0.0. Right, that means we can use that simplified form of the moment equation, right? So we can look at the sum of the moments about 0.0 is the rate of change of the angular momentum about 0.0. And in this case, the planar case, that's pretty easy to figure out. We can write it like that. What's the I sub O there? Yeah, moment of inertia and remember moments of inertia already always have some place they're defined about, so that's about 0.0. And then we have omega is the angular velocity. What's the angular velocity of the system, just based on how we've defined it? Yeah, theta dot. Right, so if we look at that, well, this guy's not changing. We can take two derivatives. Remember that has a direction. So we already kind of got the right-hand side of that equation, the rate of change of angular momentum. So let's look at kind of the forcing side of that equation. How do we get that? I think one part of it's really easy. You have a pure torque and capital K, right? Okay. What else do we have? Do these reaction forces contribute to the moments about 0.0? No, right? They're level arm zero. That's another reason why that's a good choice to sum our moments about. Then we don't have to worry about figuring out what those reactions are. Right? So they're not going to contribute anything. What else is contributing? Gravity, right? So you could do this thing and figure out what's contributing to moments in theta if you want. Right? Or you can do R cross F is always going to work for you. Okay. So remember, this is the position of the mass, m, position of m with respect to O. What is that vector here? We have to write it something in the I direction. Something in the J direction. Right, if we pick, we're going to use those coordinates. So if I'm, how do I get from O to M? Well, it's L cosine theta in the I direction, or L sine theta, excuse me, and minus L cosine theta in the J direction. Right, these two parts. Just writing that vector using those two directions. Okay. Well, if I do that cross product now, okay, we have I cross J is the K direction. Okay. J cross J, no, right. Does the direction of these moments acting on the system make sense physically for what we're describing? Anybody? Yes? No? Why? So we got the positive torque. We're given that one, right? So put your thumb on K. That's positive. Well, then we have gravity supplying kind of a negative moment. What does that mean for what it does to theta? It's pushing theta back to zero. Well, that makes sense. Gravity's trying to push it all the way to that, always to that equilibrium position. So these directions make sense for us. Okay, make that check. I stress that the whole semester too. Make that explicit check that what you're getting from the equations makes sense physically. We're describing physical systems here. All right, and then we see, well, hey, that does it make sense that all rotation of the system is in the k direction? We have one equation of motion, all of it's in the k direction. That make sense? Yeah, it better be if we're going to stay in this plane. All right, okay, so everything we got just makes sense. Good. All right. So we'll stick with there for now. And of course, we could simplify and do some other stuff if we want, and we will in a bit. We made an assumption here. We made an assumption about L. We said it was massless, inextensible, inflexible. What if it's not? What do we have to change? L might change. Right, so I have to consider that. I now have multiple, more than one degree of freedom to describe L, to describe the motion of the system. So you might go, just kind of draw a small diagram. So we started with that. Right? And you have that kind of continuum vibration, continuum dynamics. It could get pretty complex. One way you get at approximating that, so, well, hey, let's let it bend in the middle as an approximation. And that gets you some information about the dynamics of that kind of string vibration of that thing. Right? Or actually, that doesn't give me quite as much information as I need. Let it bend in two places. Now you have kind of three angles that describe the angle of that cable as it's bending. Or let it bend in 1,000 places. What does that sound like to you guys? Approximating a continuous system by little segments of mass and springs between. What's that? It's an integral. What method that you guys love to put in your senior projects presentations? FEA. This is that idea there is the heart of FEA. I'm going to take some continuous deformable body and model it as a bunch of little discrete ones with connections between them. So that's one way we could get at what this string would do if it's flexible. But I just wanted to kind of point out that is the kind of progression. We are going to work largely in those two throughout the semester. You keep extending that idea out to higher degrees of freedom, you can end up in the limit at FEA. All right. Okay. Questions about that? Simple example. You'll get tired of seeing pendulums as well. Masses and springs and pendulums. So we're going to be tired of them. But you're going to be tired of them because we can describe a huge number of systems by combinations of masses and springs and pendulums. So, in that case, we'll go up again if we need to. Chapter 1, it's all about free vibration of one degree of freedom systems. Okay. And again, free vibration for us means we don't have any non-conservative external forces acting on the system. Okay. So, we've seen a pendulum already today. Let's look at a mass with a spring bring constant K. All right. And I'm going to prescribe for us, at least for now, that I want to describe that mass's position using y, its distance from its hanger, if you will. Okay. So I want to write some equations of motion for this mass, ideal mass spring system. Okay. What's my first step? Free body diagram. Good. Okay. What kind of forces do we have acting on the system? We have gravity. Spring force. We sure do. I'm going to draw it that way. We'll talk, as the semester goes, you get to kind of choose which direction you draw these arrows. The method I tend to use is if the variable I'm interested in moves in a positive direction, so in this case, y positive is down, what direction does the spring force act? That's the way I tend to draw it for myself. You just have to draw them in a way that's consistent with how you pick out the actual coefficient there. So that's up to you. You'll get the same equations of motion. Okay? Excuse me. So we have that. What else do we need to choose here? Kind of problem set up, the preliminary steps of solving our problem. Some kind of coordinate system, sure. What's a good choice here? Some kind of x, y. We can do it that way if we want. Okay. And y positive is going to be down, so we could have done it. Maybe a y prime down if we wanted to align better with positive y is always going to be in a positive y prime direction. Positive y is always going to be in the negative y direction. But we're fine. Okay. We picked this one degree of freedom, so we're saying that, hey, it doesn't have any motion in x anyway. So we can kind of we see this is a planar problem. We see this is one degree of freedom. We can kind of ignore the vector stuff for now. Okay. So in that case, we know and we know all this stuff has to be for this problem. We're only in one degree of freedom. That thing's only bouncing up and down. What's the sum of forces acting on this mass? Force of spring and force of gravity. Right. I'm defining the direction of those based on y positive being down. So I've made that, I've kind of implicitly chosen this y down frame. Okay. What's the MA? Well, the M is M. What's the vector? What's the acceleration of that mass? If its position's y, what's its acceleration? Thank you. So we have an equation of motion. Describing the free vibration of that mass. What's the force of the spring? What we want to be able to do is write that in terms of our generalized coordinate we've picked, y. Okay. In general, what's the force from a linear approximation of a spring? Okay, delta. Hooke's law, right? What's delta for the system? The change in y. Is it just the change in y here? Change in y from its equilibrium, right? So there's some length in this space up and down where that spring is at equilibrium, right? And because we've measured y from an absolute position, we're not really accounting for that equilibrium distance in that. So in our case, our displacement of that spring is y minus L, where L is the equilibrium length. So we have an equation of motion now. It looks like that. Okay. This is, however, not the friendliest way that we could write this equation. Okay. I mentioned we had a choice of how we describe our generalized coordinates. So let's look at what that choice can do for these equations of motion for us. Okay. What I'm going to recognize is that the motion of y, right, is some equilibrium position of the system plus some kind of motion around that equilibrium. Okay. So this mass is just sitting here. Right? I let it go. And it settles to an equilibrium spot. Right? There's some distance y that represents that kind of y naught, let's say, equilibrium distance. And then any vibration that happens is going to happen around that place. Okay. So that's what this equation is saying. Did I have vibration around an equilibrium position? And we're going to use this kind of formulation a lot, right? That pendulum, right? It oscillates around theta equals zero for the most part. This is going to have some equilibrium position that the system bounces up and down around that spot. Okay. So what effect does that have on my equation of motion? Well, let's look at, well, how do I figure out what y naught is? What's that equilibrium position? When does that happen here? When it's at rest. What does that mean for, let's say, this guy? Zero. Yeah, the y double dot term is zero. If it's at rest, then it's going to stay at rest forever, which is what kind of equilibrium means, right? So if that's zero, that gives us some information about the spring force and the gravitational force. They equal zero means they're balanced exactly for all time. So at equilibrium, which is y naught, right, we have that has to be true. Right, gravity and that spring force are balanced exactly there. If you set a system down in its equilibrium spot, it never moves ever if it's not acted on externally. All right, so given those two pieces, let's look at our equations of motion again. Well, if I have my double dot, if I take two derivatives of this, this guy is constant, right? So that just becomes x double dot, right? The y double dot, again, two derivatives of this, that's constant, so I just have two derivatives of x, acceleration of x, okay? Mg. And then equation starts to look like that. Okay. Let's group some terms. I want what have we said about these guys? Why not plus x, not minus x? I knew that looked weird. What do we know about this. Yeah, they're just zero. We've said that because that's our definition there. So our equation of motion then becomes which describes the vibration of that system about its equilibrium spot. Why not? Okay. So this is a much simpler differential equation to solve than this one. Not by a whole lot, but it is. So, kind of giving it away, we have to solve this differential equation in order to figure out what x of t is, the time response of the system, right? Which is ultimately what we're often after. So given that equation of motion, it describes how that mass bounces up and down based on that spring under influence of gravity around its equilibrium spot, why not? How do I get to the time response? Well, I solve that differential equation. How do I solve that differential equation? Before we get to that, how kind of differential equation is this? The second order. What else can we say about it? Linear or nonlinear? So linear differential equation. Only the variable of interest and its derivatives show up. Okay. What else can we say? Are m and k changing in this case? So it's constant coefficient, linear, constant coefficient, second order. Do we have any forcing function? Right. No forcing function, so you'll hear it called autonomous. Right. So we have a linear, second order, constant coefficient, autonomous differential equation. How do we solve those? 350 was a long time ago, I know. Differential equations run the world. Brush up on them. You find some roots and stuff? Sure. Let's step through that procedure. We'll do a 350 review for you. So at some point, some smart person figured out the differential equations of this form, linear, constant coefficient, autonomous differential equations, have a solution of this form. So the way we solve these, generally, is to assume a solution of that form, then plug it into the differential equation and solve, and try to figure out what A and lambda need to be to make it work. All right. So in this case, we need to know x, right? We're going to need to know x. We need to know x double dot. So we get the x double dot. And then we take those things and just plug them into the differential equation. So we have m that has to be true. We can factor some stuff out if we like. Okay. So now, for this equation to be true, what has to happen? This guy has to equal zero. What are the other ways it could be true? Kind of two others. Or one other, I guess. This A could be zero, not an acceleration. This is just a coefficient in this case. Okay. So A could be zero, but that's not going to give us a very interesting answer. Right. Could the e to the lambda t ever be zero? No, it's not. Right. T has to go out to infinity in order for that to happen. So that term actually never goes to zero. We could let A be zero, and then we're saying that, hey, the system never moves ever for all time. Well, that's a solution, but it's not a very interesting one. So what we're going to say, if this is going to be true, then that has to happen. Okay. We saw this. Plus or minus. Yeah, roots plus or minus I square root of k over m. And then what we know then is that my solution has to include both of those. There we go. And there's a t there too. Sorry about that. Okay. So here's our solution. To a differential equation that looks like this one. How do you think I figure out what A1 and A2 need to be? Initial conditions is what gets me there. Forgot an E too. Sorry about that. So I figure out what those coefficients need to be based on the initial conditions in my system. So you'd be given, in this case, a position, initial position, initial velocity. And you plug in here and figure out what A1 and A2 need to be. Okay. This equation looks kind of weird, probably. Right? What are these exponentials and complex numbers and stuff floating around? How else could I write this? Sines and cosines. How do I get from exponentials to sines and cosines? Let's see, I'll match how I write it. What's that relationship? So E plus or minus I omega t, see the meaning of omega in a second, equals what? Cosine omega t. And we can handle both sines, plus or minus, sine. I sine omega t. So with that, we get to an equation that we can equivalently write sorry, I want to match what I wrote here for you. Whether we, we're not doing lamp omega yet. We could write an equation like that. Okay. And again, we would have to figure out what B1 and B2 are based on the initial conditions we're given for the problem. Okay. What is this square root of k over m thing floating around? What does it tell us about that response? It's a natural frequency. What does that really mean, though? I agree. We're going to call that natural frequency. What does it tell us? It's oscillation rate, something like that. Right? If I write in a name, if I let this thing go and it vibrates without any external excitation, that's the frequency it naturally oscillates at. So maybe I displace this system by x naught. So I took, and I'm just pulling it, I'm holding it there, zero velocity, and I let it go. What's going to happen? I heard somebody say it. It's going to oscillate, right? Pull this thing down, right? Pull it down, away from its equilibrium spot, and I let it go. It's going to oscillate up and down around that equilibrium. So the response then looks... something like that. Right. And actually, what we'll see for this case, since we don't have any damping, is this plus or minus x naught. Okay. So then what the natural frequency tells me is something about how fast this thing bounces back and forth between those limits. Okay. We can look at a relationship there. What's tau? So tau, in vibrations terminology, we'll call it the period of oscillation, or just period, quite often. Okay, how is that related to the natural frequency? Yeah, it's kind of the inverse. Depends on what units we've chosen for natural frequency, right? So, if we do it in seconds, where omega n is our natural frequency, is what we're going to use for natural frequency almost always, omega n. Okay. And this holds true, and these are units, seconds. For omega n, so that tau is 2 pi over omega n. Right. And what we'll see, and what we'll use to our advantage later, is that that happens all the time, right? It's, as long as we don't have any external forces of that, it's always oscillating at its natural frequency. Right. So we have a tau there, we have a tau here, we have a 2 times tau for counting out multiple periods. So we'll use that to our advantage later when we have some system where we may not know the equation of motion and we're trying to get information about it. We can look at a response and pick off stuff that matters. Okay. You often see natural frequency described in hertz. And some people use a F for that quite often. So I can get from divide by 2 pi to get from radians to second to hertz, right? And then I also could write my period is 1 over the natural frequency in hertz. Those things you need to know. Okay. Much of our analysis is going to be based on knowing and being able to figure out the natural frequency of a system you're given and using that to determine what its response is to any kind of given input. So you have to pick those out, know when to use either version, radians, or second, or hertz. Let's look at one more thing here before we move on to another example. Let's rewrite this. I'm going to divide both sides by m. What does this coefficient look like? It's close to natural frequency. Natural frequency squared. If you have an equation and you can get it into this form, square root of that term is going to be your natural frequency. Okay. Questions so far? No questions. Right, so let's look at this. Let's take a little bit. Let's see which way we want to do this. Okay? Let's take a look at these spring-type systems. We're dealing a lot with masses and springs. Okay, let's look at one system. I want to be able to simplify that if we can. Right. Certainly we could try to model this directly, and it's not so hard to do, but I'd love to be able to write it as some kind of equivalent stiffness there. It might be based on K1 and K2. So for these systems, you have springs in series. Okay. Looks like that. Okay. I'd like to be able to do the same thing with that system if I can. And you probably can guess, since we're talking about it, you can. Those springs are in parallel. Think back to your circuits days. What does that look like to you? Resistors. Right? So springs in parallel look like resistors in series. Springs in series look like resistors in parallel. In terms of the equivalent resistance, that kind of thing. Right? And this could continue out. If I had three, I'd just add those on there. Or I could have two springs in parallel and then one, another set that's in series, and you can kind of work through the problem that way, just like you might do with a resistor network, or probably did with a resistor network and circuit. So quite often, this can save you some time being able to recognize, certainly, again, we can model that directly, but recognizing this gets you to that right away. Equivalent springs. Let's take a short aside. Say we have a plot here. We have on the vertical axis the force from a spring. Horizontal axis we have that displacement. We've said so far that, hey, that force should be exactly proportional based on some kind of k to that displacement, right? What does that look like on this graph? Just a straight line, right? And furthermore, it goes through zero, right? So no displacement, I got no force. So let me try to draw a line. Looks something like that. Okay, so that's Hooke's law, rule for a spring. Does a real spring look like that? Okay, what happens to a real spring? Yeah, so if I can't stretch it out forever and still be getting a force exactly proportional to it. I can't compress it forever It's still beginning force. It's just proportional to how I compressed it, right? So you'll see other models for springs. One that might look something like that. So you see maybe that's kind of another common example you would deal with, especially if you went to graduate vibrations. But even that, right, even if your spring is acting like this, and this is still just an approximation, right, because a real spring, stretch it enough, it's going to break, and you can't compress it forever either, right? So even one of those are approximations, but if I look in this area here, hey, that's a pretty good approximation. Okay. How close you have to be to zero displacement for it to be a good enough approximation really depends on your application. But no, like we've talked, and we'll talk all semester, that's an approximation. Right? So if you're using that model of a spring, your model is inherently wrong somewhere in this configuration. Okay. Is it wrong enough to matter for your application? Maybe not. In fact, F equals KX gets used all the time and works pretty well. Okay. But just having in your mind that is actually an approximation of reality, just like any other model you're going to make in your life. But it turns out to be a pretty good approximation if I'm oscillating around kind of my equilibrium length. Right. This is a linearization, right? We linearize that nonlinear spring force into a linear approximation of it about zero. That's going to come up in 10 minutes. All right, equivalent springs. Let's go back. To our pendulum problem. Section 1.3 in your book. Okay, so we had a pendulum. I'll draw it up. We've already done this once today, so I think we'll get through it quickly. Gravity. Okay, and in this case, we're not going to have any external force. So, as you saw from earlier today, we got to a set of equations that looked like this. If I set that external torque to zero, right? So I'm skipping some steps here that I'm telling you never to skip. So don't do that. Make sure you do those steps, but we've already done them once, so I don't think we need to do them again right now. Okay. I can write this equation like so. Okay. What's different about this compared to our spring differential equation? It's nonlinear. Why is it nonlinear? Yeah, so my differential equation here depends not just on the state, right? It depends on the sign of that state. So it's nonlinear. So then we have a couple choices, right? We can solve this nonlinear differential equation if we want. Right? That's never much fun. Or we can linearize this system. So, let's talk about linearization. We're going to linearize the system. Right? We have to pick a point in its configuration about which we want to linearize it. Okay. So kind of like we did on the mass system, we picked maybe about some equilibrium condition. That's often a good place to linearize a nonlinear system. Right? if you know you're going to be operating around your equilibrium, right? If you know your system is going to be operating somewhere other than your equilibrium, that's where you need to linearize. If I have a robot arm, highly nonlinear system, it's always reached out kind of about this far, that would be where I wanted to linearize the system, even if that wasn't a natural equilibrium of it, of the system. Okay, so you get to pick, right? Key point of linearization. The linearization you do, you have to get to pick the point, and the linearization that you do, that method, is only valid around that point. Okay, so linearization is not valid over the entire space. Just like we saw in our spring, you got up here, there was a big difference between the linear approximation and the actual spring force. Okay, same thing happens with nonlinear dynamics. The farther you get away from where you linearize the system, the bigger the difference is between what the system's actually doing and your linear approximation of it. Okay, so in this case, let's linearize about an equilibrium. We know we don't have any external forces, so we think that the system would settle to some kind of equilibrium and oscillate about over there. Okay. So how do I get to what the equilibrium position of the system is? Yeah, sine of zero. So how do I get there? Right? If it's at equilibrium, then I don't have any acceleration. Equilibrium just sits there. And we'll sit there forever. Right? So if I take all my motion terms and set them to zero, right, then I know, hey, well, at equilibrium, mgl sine theta is zero. Well, mg and l, are none of those guys are zero. So what we need to happen for equilibrium or at equilibrium, sine theta has to be zero. Okay? Well, when is the sine of theta zero? One. When else can it be zero? 180. And actually, n pi describes this case too, when n is just zero. Okay. So actually, I have two different equilibrium conditions, right? If I think about the circle, I have theta is zero, theta is 180, theta is 360. You need to round the circle that way. Right. For this pendulum, which one of those particular equilibrium conditions makes sense? Zero. Right. I have the mass below the kind of pivot point. When might this one make sense? If I was modeling this a system like kind of pendulum-like system. It's making a full rotation. I think that's a good point. So if this thing could make a full rotation, say I was driving this thing around. Right, I don't think either linearization is going to make sense, right? Because I'm going to be deviating a long ways from that equilibrium every time. Okay? So if you're worried about a system of equations that's valid for all time, for all configurations, you wouldn't be linearizing, actually. Okay? When might the case up here make sense? What kind of systems? Inverted pendulum. What are some common inverted pendulums? Segway, right? Person, right? We're inverted pendulums, right? Rockets, right? Anywhere we have a center of mass above where it might pivot around. We have what we're describing as a pendulum, so we'll pick that guy. Okay. So we picked our equilibrium. So we're going to say theta equilibrium. Zero is what we're going to linearize about. We'll look at one way to linearize systems. There's a whole kind of field of mathematics and dynamics, vibrations research dedicated to efficient ways to linearize nonlinear systems. We'll look at one, the most common one. Okay. What we are going to do. Based on Taylor series expansion. I look at the Taylor series expansion of sine theta. Anybody remember what that is? I'll give you the first term.
So it's an odd function.
It goes out to infinity, that following that pattern. Okay. So we said, hey, well, the Taylor series expansion of sine theta. That's the term, that's our nonlinear term there. It's theta plus some other stuff. If you look at that and say, well, hey, this system we know is kind of vibrating, and we know we only really need an approximation of that function that's valid near small angles around theta equilibrium equals zero. Okay. So what we're saying is that, hey, theta is kind of small, much less than one. Okay. And you can, if you want to be picky about it, the magnitude is much less than one. So when this is true, what's the relationship between theta and theta to the third? Right, so we say, if this is true, then theta is much bigger than those higher order terms. If I take a really, really small number, and cubit, I get a really, really, really small number. I can effectively ignore that term. Take the fifth, it's even smaller. I can ignore that term. Right? And those exponentials are getting higher. Those powers are getting higher as we go, so we can ignore all those extra terms. So what this gives us is four small angles. Hopefully you've seen that before. Often heard that called small angle approximation. How small is small? Short answer, it depends. Right? It really depends on what kind of precision you need in your model that you're using this for. All right, so probably get tired of hearing me say that. It depends. So if we take this approximation, actually, before we do that, what's the kind of other piece of that? If you're looking at small angles, cosine of theta is what? Really? One, yeah. So small angles, you see that to be true. So if we linearize this system now, using that approximation, we get what's called a linearized equation of motion. And we include the linearized to make the distinction that this is representing a linearized version of that actual of the actual system dynamics. Okay, so here's the full nonlinear equation of motion. This is the linearized version of it. Okay. What is I naught here? Or I O, sub O. So that was the moment of inertia earlier. What is it for this particular system? ML squared, well, yeah, that's right. For this particular system, we have a point mass in pure rotation about a point at a distance of L. Right? So it's just ML squared. So I can do let's divide by ML squared. What does that look like? In form. Yeah, it's the same form of the equation we got for the mass spring system. So what's the natural frequency of this pendulum system? Square root of g over l, right? Remember that this guy, we get n squared. So the natural frequency for our linearized pendulum square root of g over l. And we can go down the same route, or in fact know that the equation is still going to have this form. It's just in thetas instead of x's. Omega n there. So that'll be a large part of the work we do, is the pushing equations towards a form that looks like this, for which we readily know the solution. Okay. Questions? None at all? What happens to that equation up here? What's different about it? Well, gravity is always going to be, well, the gravity is the same, its effect is different. What's the effect of gravity when it's up top? It's going to make the angle larger, basically, right? So this equilibrium point up top is not one that's generally stable. Right? Any non-zero deviation from that equilibrium gets you to an unstable condition. Right? How about this guy? Is this a stable equilibrium position? Right. Gravity is always wanting to push us back. Our external force is always pushing us back to theta equals zero, towards the equilibrium. So that would be another reason, in the general case, to maybe choose theta equals zero. If you weren't saying, hey, this was explicitly an inverted pendulum or a regular pendulum. Right? You can pick a stable equilibrium position instead of an unstable. All right, and it's a good place to stop for today. See you guys on Thursday.